What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is
Dariana. We call him Day-Day for short.
Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Absolutely.
And along those lines of what you just said, I can think of a lot of people that I don't like.
Yeah.
And if I was with them and someone was meant to do them harm, they would have to go through me to do it. I wouldn't think twice. When you think about your career and the things that you've done, there's been several times where, gunfire, where, I mean, when it's all over, the adrenaline's now going away and everything else, and you look back and it's like, man, why did I do that? My wife could have been without a husband and,
right.
and kids without a dad. I mean, I wasn't thinking. I just went and did. And that's really the mentality that we all have is that we are putting our service of everyone else above the safety and security of ourselves, and we don't even think about it. There's not even a hesitation.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the next episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Thank you folks so much for coming back every week. We're coming up on the end of our fourth year with the Game of Crimes. You know, I bring a special guest on every show. This week is no different. You can tell I'm not home in my home studio. We're out in San Diego at a conference. You guys that have listened for a while, you know, this is the one I come to every year. I think this is my eighth year attending this conference. And they surprised me this year by telling me I'm now an honorary member of the board of directors here. So that is a title and a badge that I wear very proudly. I had no idea they were going to do that. Just honored to be here. But like we do every week, I bring you a stud or a studette on the show, mostly law enforcement, current and former. We bring in military heroes as well. And, you know, occasionally I bring in a former bad guy. So this week, though, is a very special guest. I'm a little bit awestruck. It took me, I'm going to guess, 10, 15 minutes to get him back here in this room so we could do the interview. And it's because he's running for governor of California. And when we finished the opening ceremonies for this conference, the people were lined up back of the aisles just to get a picture with him. And these are police officers. As we were coming back into the little studio here, I told him, I said, man, if you've got the uniforms wanting pictures with you, that's a testament to how much they respect you, how much they want you to take that position as the governor of California. So, ladies and gentlemen, a true honor for me to welcome Chad Bianco to the Game of Crimes. Sheriff, welcome, brother. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be sitting here with you. This should be a good one.
Well, it's like I tell some of my guests, let's see how you feel after I finish the interview.
I always feel good.
The man's got a smile. He's very charismatic. His background, 32 years with the Riverside County Sheriff's Department. Started off coming out of the academy, I'm guessing, just a road deputy?
Straight to the jail. I did a couple of years in the jail. Actually, introduction into gang enforcement. I was a corrections deputy. But I was assigned a classification, so I interviewed everybody that came in. We were in charge of housing and all that stuff. And, of course, inside a corrections facility, gangs and race is a huge issue. Mm-hmm. So that was my introduction, my first trainings and conference and everything else. So that's where I started, did a couple of years there, then off to patrol. Typically in a sheriff's office, especially in California, mm-hmm. you go straight from the academy to corrections, and then you start your patrol time.
And that's very common. Thank you for explaining that, because I know on the East Coast, it's pretty much the same thing. You got to do your jail time and then you hit the road.
Yeah. And as I say that, after I became the sheriff, I changed it here.
Did you?
Yeah. So we have a completely different career. We're a very large agency. I have a completely different career path in corrections and patrol, and they are separate. So we have correctional deputies and patrol deputies. So
Excellent. It's
different classifications.
And 32 years with the SO? And you were just telling me, I mean, you retired and then came back, is that right?
I didn't actually retire, but I set my date. I had notified PERS and everything was all set for me to retire. October 23rd, 2017 was going to be a retirement date for me. And lots of things happened after then.
Yeah, here we are in 2025 and you're still wearing a badge.
Still wearing a badge. I'm the sheriff now, and I was a lieutenant back then. And next year we do this again, I may be the governor.
Well, that looks, what I've seen so far, this is like, looks like you got a really good shot here. So let's just get into a little bit about your background, where you grew up, your family dynamics. Do you have law enforcement, where you went to school, what your ambitions were, and you just run with it?
Sure, absolutely. I grew up in a very, very small mining town in Utah. Helper, Utah, 1,200 people in the town. I think in the entire county, there were 18,000, roughly about 18,000 people in the county, one high school for the entire county. So very small, everyone knew each other. I grew up the oldest of three boys. My mom and dad were very young when they had kids, and a very tight family, both sides of the family, both grandparents on both sides, and we just had a great upbringing. I was blessed, very athletic, and so I was very involved in sports. I was very competitive in wrestling, golf, and baseball, but baseball was my favorite. That was my sport. And talk about dreams. No, I never wanted to be a law enforcement officer. My dreams were I was supposed to be, probably about now, I was supposed to be being inducted into Major League Baseball Hall of Fame. But, you know, it is, as we get older, we realize that our plans for ourselves aren't usually what God's plans for us are, and our lives take different turns and we end up in different places. So athletics is really what drove me out of the small town, college scholarship to play baseball. And wow. Eventually I moved to California. Baseball is what brought me to California. I was 11 years old. I came to Santa Monica, California to play in the Little League World Series. And how it worked is they house you with foster families. So The team is split into two players go with a foster family. And this family was amazing. I was 11, and they had a 13-year-old son and a 16-year-old daughter. And they just took us and immersed us in Santa Monica. I mean, the beach, the pier, the downtown. We went to one of their friends' birthday parties and in the park, and we just did so much with them. I absolutely fell in love with it. After the whole baseball thing was over, I went home and told my parents. I said, hey, I'm moving to California.
And at 11 years old.
At 11. And they told me I had to wait till I was an adult, but that stayed with me. I knew that eventually after my baseball career was over, I would be moving to California, and that's what brought me here. And
what position in baseball?
In my last 3 years of college, I played three different positions. So I was mostly a middle infielder, but I guess I was in every single game because of hitting. I DH'd my first year of college. I was a DH.
Wow.
Then a second baseman, then a left fielder and first baseman, and then I ended up as a second baseman my senior year, once in a while rotating off between first base and second base. But they'd keep me in for defense, move things around, but I was always in for my bat.
So. Well, what a great utility player.
I was blessed. I wasn't blessed big, but I was blessed talented. And I say all the time, I was at the time in the 80s, the mid-80s, and I watched the introduction of steroids into baseball, and especially into college, watching from 1 year to the next the size difference of a player that we were playing against. And that just wasn't for me. Growing up with wrestling, I was always concerned about my health. I was always concerned about what was going into my body. I was always maintaining weight. Lifting weights, doing those types of things for strength and for baseball. And I was just afraid of drugs. I've never tried drugs. I have to admit, once in a while, especially as a kid, I drank. I had a beer every now and then, but I just couldn't get into drugs. I didn't like them. And so then the steroid aspect, I couldn't do it. It was offered, and they were telling us, if you want to be competitive, you have to do it. And I just couldn't do it. And there was a difference. They were drafting at the time the big, monstrous players, the Maguires and the Cansecos were just emerging into the big leagues. And all these college players, you could tell, most of them, that's what they were doing. But that's okay. I have no regrets.
No, because you're displaying integrity and leadership at a very young age. You and I were a minority that we'd never smoked weed.
Yeah.
You're exhibiting leadership principles and aspects there at a very young age. Good for you.
Yeah, and that's just how I was brought up, I guess. Very close relationship with my grandparents and my parents, and there just weren't any secrets, and they were very open with us. My dad, growing up, knew what he did growing up, and so he anticipated me doing the same thing, and he was very open about knowing that I was doing that and that responsibility and you're responsible for your actions, and there are consequences for actions and everything else. And that really resonated with me. So that's how I ended up going away to college because of baseball. And tiny little story, because there is a little bit of a nuance to it, but I was 16 years old and I got pulled over with some friends, and we were in a car and we had alcohol in the car. And of course we got tickets, underage drinking. And it was interesting because the highway patrolman, he knew who I was because of baseball. And so he pulled me back last out of the car, and I was sitting in his car, and he was giving me my citation. And I just got the lecture, the same lecture that my dad had given me, but it was coming from not only a cop, but from another adult. And one of the things for me is growing up is I was raised to respect adults. There was yes sirs and yes ma'ams, and it didn't matter who the adult was, you respected your elders. And so I had this guy in uniform in a cop car, but he was an adult, and he was talking to me like an adult. And of course, I wasn't getting out of the ticket, but he knew all about me and baseball and small town, and telling me that baseball was my ticket out of that town. And I was kind of at a crossroads of you either need to decide if you really want to do this whole baseball thing, or if you just want to be the party kid and hang out with all your friends and get into trouble and go down a path that might stop your baseball career. And I remember pulling away. We were all, my friends were mad that we got tickets and everything else. And I was just embarrassed. I was embarrassed that of what he said to me. And baseball really was my life at that time. And it was like, man, I don't want to lose baseball. And I guess this is kind of dumb. And it just, I was truly embarrassed. I was embarrassed that I was going to have to go tell my dad that I got a ticket. But that experience of how he talked to me really changed my impression of law enforcement, because as a kid, like on our motorcycles in the hills, we're running from the cops, and you don't want to get caught by the cops. That's part of being a kid. Even though you're not doing anything bad, right, the cops are after you. And it was a big turning point for me, because I had so much respect for the way he talked to me, not as an authority figure, but as a person just telling me I was going down the wrong path. And so as I ended up in God's world and plans for me, and finally ended up in law enforcement, I know that I have been able to influence kids the same way that I was, because that meant a lot to me. And I didn't realize it as I got into the profession, but as I started dealing with younger kids and kids that were having issues or something like that, I realized that was me. And I'm telling this person the same thing that that guy told me. And so I know I impacted lives, and I'm hoping that eventually I meet some adult that says, you changed my life. I tried to go back and find that highway patrolman, and I knew his name. I remembered his name, and he had died about 6 months earlier. And so I wasn't able to tell him thank you. And at the time, I was a lieutenant in the sheriff's department when I thought about, man, I got to go back there and try and let him know that. And so that was a little bit of a regret that I wish I would have thought about that sooner. But small town come to California, it truly was for the California dream. And I came out here, I dabbled, just finding a job and some construction a little bit, worked for a roofing company and some sales for some construction equipment. And then I ended up working in the service department of a Ford dealership, and had a really good friend that we worked out every morning together. And he was part-time in a sheriff's academy after work, and he was telling me about it. I knew he was in it, and he was having a good time. And then he's telling me about this, I should do it full time, and I'd have to quit, my wife would have to support me and everything, and all those things. But eventually I just got interested, and I was like, man, that's good money, it'd be a good job. I did it, and I had to put myself through the academy back then. Budgets were horrible here in California.
Wow.
And there was no one hiring. They were just wait for you to put yourself through the academy, pick the cream of the crop, and then they would get to pick who they'd know you were going to graduate for one, and then they know how you did in the academy and whether or not they were going to pick you. But that's how it worked. I got hired the day after I graduated. And I really only wanted to work for Riverside anyway. I went to a different county's academy, San Bernardino's academy. That's where I was working at that dealership in the time, so it was natural to get into that one. But I lived in Riverside County, and I only wanted to work there. So I ended up finishing extremely well in my academy.
You did. You graduated number one. You're being humble and won't say it.
Yeah, and and they picked me up right after that, and it was just a natural.
Yeah.
It was a natural. And a lot of times, you mentioned leadership, and we talked this morning at the opening of the conference about leadership and everything. There's something, as me growing up and getting to where I am today as a leader, and I've always requested to go to leadership classes as trainings and things like that, and I was never sent. And for whatever reason, I don't know. I've read little, maybe a little article or something about leadership, and I know what the difference in leadership styles are. But as I progressed through my career, I realized, and listening back to myself and to what was told to me after my graduation, I think that leadership is a lost art for sure. But I think it's a combination. For sure you can learn leadership, but I truly do believe that in my case, I was born into it. And it was just something, and it could have been learned because of my parents and my grandparents and those things of growing up, that's how I learned it. But that's not something official that I can look back and say, this is why everyone considers me a good leader. So it's probably a combination of everything. But I do realize, and I have realized recently, that if I would have been able to go to classes, if they would have sent me to classes, I would have learned about the different leadership types and everything else. And I'm extremely competitive in everything that I do. And I feel like I would have pigeonholed myself into a style, into a leadership style. And it may have hindered my ability to be the leader that I'm considered today in the law enforcement world, because I realized that we're dealing with, I've got 4,400 employees, and that's 4,400 different personalities that don't all react the same to the same leader. And that leader has to be the leader for 4,400 individuals, not just one team.
Right.
And you've got to make them a team. So I think it's a combination of birthright and how I was born, how I was raised, and then growing up in this and looking at different leaders that I didn't look at them as leaders at the time. They were supervisors, but I said, I like a lot of the things that supervisor does, but I don't like this.
Yeah.
And I like these things over here, but I don't like that. And so as I started to promote, I really wanted to make sure that I didn't do those things that I didn't like. If I didn't like it, more than likely other people didn't like it either.
Right. And not only your upbringing, but that first encounter with the law enforcement at 16 years old, and that's at a time when law enforcement had the discretion to make decisions on the street. And, I mean, thank the good man upstairs that the police officer that approached you took an interest in you, whether you like it or not, or whether you realize it or not. That's the way law enforcement used to be. Now, I believe after 38 years as a cop, I think cops today want to have that discretion to have a positive influence on especially young people. But man, it's like the way times are now. People want it to be black or white.
Yeah.
And as you're telling me, the reason I was smiling, because I had my first run-in with cops at 10 years old.
Oh, boy.
And it was middle of the night trying to break in a house with my buddies because we were camping out. And the police officer had such a profound effect on me at 10 years old, 11 years old, whatever I was. I wanted to be one of them. And it's amazing how you have an impact on people later on in your career. So I love the fact that you got that familiar background having an influence on you. But then just by the grace of God, a police officer comes in and has a positive effect on you. Just, you know, and that's what this show is about, putting law enforcement in the most positive light so that our listeners learn we're not just out there to put people in jail and write tickets. We don't have quotas. That's a popular myth, but the reality is I don't know any agencies that have quotas.
No, I've never heard that. I mean, I've heard it. I mean, you hear that all the time, but the friends I have, the different agencies that I have now, my associates that are leaders all across the country, there's no such thing. And as we are dealing with what we're dealing with the media now and with the negativity toward law enforcement and politicians that are very disingenuous and dishonest, it's their attempt to demonize us. It's another one of those things for, they have quotas. That's the only reason. I didn't do anything wrong. It's a cop getting a quota, so he's lying to get his quotas or cheating or doing whatever. And it was something that was non-existent that just came up that became urban legend.
Yeah, exactly.
And people believed it. And even to get even more political now, it's the same thing about racism. It's like all cops are racist. That's what they want you to believe. And in a cop's perspective, we all look at each other and it's like, we're the furthest thing from racist. Yeah. I mean, I look at my agency and I have, especially in the political world, because now I'm coming under fire, but I've got 4,400 employees that pretty much is a microcosm of California. I have every single race. I have a male, female. I have men married to men. I have women married to women. I have transgenders that we have hired and put through the academy that are now deputies. And there is no one. I mean, 32 years in this agency, and I know every one of my employees. I have never thought, oh, man, that guy's a racist. Or, oh, man, he does, you know, whatever the case may be. It's either Are you a good person or are you a bad person? Mm-hmm. That's all we care about. Nobody cares about what color you are or about who you're holding hands with when you go home or whatever the case may be. Are you ethical? Are you moral? Are you here for the good or are you here for the bad? And that's really all we care about. But that demonization of us, they want you to believe that we are this racist group of gangsters that are going out demonizing everyone or terrorizing the public, when truly we're just a whole bunch of moms and dads and good people that put on a badge to go make our community better.
Who made a commitment to serve and protect, to put yourself in harm's way for people that, I mean, quite literally, a lot of these people that we protect hate us.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, I don't know. I said this during a campaign, and I don't know why I came up with this or how I came up with it. I learned later that, I mean, it's not, I didn't come up with the words and they go together. But we have since changed it to make the motto of our agency, and it's on all our cars and everything else. And everything that we do, our badging is service above self. And I truly do believe that if you are a successful law enforcement officer, you have to actually be capable of serving others before yourself.
Absolutely.
And along those lines of what you just said, I can think of a lot of people that I don't like.
Yeah.
And if I was with them and someone was meant to do them harm, they would have to go through me to do it, and I wouldn't think twice. And when you think about your career and the things that you've done, there's been several times where gunfire, I mean, when it's all over, the adrenaline's now going away and everything else, and you look back and it's like, man, why did I do that? My wife could have been without a husband and kids without a dad. I mean, I wasn't thinking. I just went and did. And that's really the mentality that we all have, is that we are putting our service of everyone else above the safety and security of ourselves, and we don't even think about it. There's not even a hesitation.
Yeah, that running towards the ground shots, not running away from them.
That's right.
I'm one of those that run away now, just so you know.
Yeah, that's.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.
So there was no law enforcement in your family?
No law enforcement in my family. So it was 1,200 people in the town. We had a chief of police. That was it. There were no police officers. It was just the chief of police. Yeah. And so everyone knew him. It was very personal, very personable. And then in the county sheriff, I mean, we all knew who the deputies were that were driving around, because there were only a few of them. And so there was always that respect. There was always that respect for authority and for law. So I always had that, but no one that I knew growing up that was in the law enforcement field. I was the first. And now my brother is in law enforcement. My brother, I'm the oldest of three. My second brother is a Superior Court judge in Los Angeles. My youngest brother is a deputy. He's a chief deputy. My daughter and my son-in-law are both deputies.
Wow.
So
you started a trend.
I
and once you get that bug, you can't walk away from it.
You can't. There's nothing else I would rather do than this. It's the adrenaline, the excitement. Doesn't matter how many burglary calls you go to, every single one of them is different, because you're dealing with other people and circumstances. And so nothing is ever the same. If you're an adrenaline junkie, you have to love it. If you love helping people, which truly that's my joy in life, or I guess my love language is what my wife calls it, is serving other people. And I hate asking for help. I hate asking for assistance in anything. I'll do it myself. I don't read directions. I just figure it out and do it myself. But I will help anybody do anything.
Yeah.
And that's just how I've always been, whether it's my wife, my kids, my friends, my coworkers, and that's really what makes me happy.
So one thing I didn't ask you is, what college did you go to?
University of Utah.
Is that the Utes?
It's the Utes. It is.
Go.
So I went to junior college first, College of Eastern Utah, and we were the Eagles. And then the University of Utah picked me up from there, and I was a Ute.
And your major was?
Physical education.
Oh, I was expecting you to say criminal justice.
Well, I have a criminal justice degree now.
Okay. So you just keep going. I love it. So when you're going through the police academy, I've been through a couple academies myself because I changed agencies. There's always funny things that go on, stupid things. Got any good stories for us?
You know, I don't know. I've never told this story. I've told it to a couple people, but it was an interesting story. We had my tax staff was there were two males and a female, and the female I was married at the time, and she was an attractive female, and she was from another country,
mm-hmm.
and so she had very thick, heavy accent, and I'm 25 years old. I was a young male, and she was very attractive, very fit, mm-hmm. and that authority figure that she's yelling at us and everything else. And so I developed a good relationship with her just because of what we were doing. And I would always get in trouble because she's supposed to be standing at attention, and she would catch me looking at her. And so then they'd all yell at me because I wasn't staring straight ahead and all those good things. But so from her country, and hopefully it comes to me, the cops version from her country came and was doing a story on her. And so they were filming our academy. They were filming her go around and everything else. And so they were doing defensive tactics. Well, defensive tactics in California are not the same as defensive tactics in her country. And so she got me. And I was going to be her dummy, her guinea pig. And so she was demonstrating these tactics and everything else. So we're going through the motions of she's doing takedowns and showing the techniques and everything else. Well, the one particular, I'm down on the ground, and she pushes away from me. And she'd already told me, she said, when I get off of you, get up quick and turn toward me. She gets off of me, and this is all on camera. I get off, she gets off of me, and I jump up and I turn to her, and she kicked me right in the chest. And she's this major martial arts expert. And in her country, that's what they did. There wasn't really guns. It was martial arts. And she worked me over from then on out. Everyone was making fun of me later because everyone's watching and they're all laughing. It's like, oh my gosh, what's happening? But it was another Denmark. I can't remember what country she was from.
So European country.
It was a European country, and it was their version of cops. But that country watched me get beat up by my TAC officer, and they made it out like that's what we were teaching here, and that's what she was doing. But it was just for the TV show.
Yeah, oh, that's hilarious. And that's a different story than I've ever heard from all the cops we've had on Game of Crimes here.
Well, we all have the same. There are always similar stories of people doing dumb things and everything else. I remember the beginning of our academy, it was a high-stress academy. And so at 7 o'clock in the morning, it's you run from the parking lot into formation, and they start yelling at you. And there was this kid, I had parked next to him. And so, I mean, they're yelling at us to get out there. So we run out there, and they stopped him on the way out there. And we were running together, and I'm running out to get in this formation. And I just sensed that they were yelling at him, and he didn't even make it there. I mean, they basically said, you don't belong here, turn around and go home. And he did. And it was like, wow. Holy moly. So I was not in the military. I didn't go through a boot camp. So that was initial for me,
mm-hmm.
and very shocking, very shocking. It was crazy being yelled at that morning, and he's yelling in my face, and as he's yelling, he spit, and it just like a little, not like spitting, but just the, as you,
it was spewing out.
Yes. And it kind of right in the corner of my eye, and I kind of flinched. And then I got in trouble
for
moving and for flinching. And was I afraid of him or what? And of course you can't say anything and you can't do anything.
Yeah.
So it was eye opening for me for sure. And then I tell you, law enforcement for me, coming from a small town, we were talking about racism a little bit. I didn't grow up with racism. There was no such thing. It just didn't exist in our small community. And so, in college, now I have, especially our football players. So I was on the baseball team, but we're all the same. Mm-hmm. When we're in the locker room, we're just college athletes.
You're a team member.
Absolutely. And so I befriended some of the football players that were from inner city Chicago, and they talked about being gang members, and we saw their tattoos and we knew they were gang members, and they would talk about it. And it was a lifestyle for them. That's just what they felt. That's what they had to do. And they talked about racism, about being victims of racism and things like that, and in growing up in sports until they just got so good that it didn't matter. When I started the jail, I remember being in the jail the first day, and we had pods, three pods. in this particular pod was they were split by race. So you had blacks in one, Hispanics, and then whites. And I remember just walking in, and I've got my training officer, and he's explaining the whole thing. And I just remember asking him, like, well, why did we separate them into race? I mean, isn't that racism? And he had just this dumb look on his face, and he said, what are you talking about? And so then I had to learn that there is racism with criminals.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some black inmates that have to be housed with blacks. There are some Hispanics that can't be housed with anything but Hispanics, and the same thing as whites. And that was new for me. That was just something that I couldn't even fathom. So that experience in the jail was very, very good for me, because small town boy from Utah, it was culture shock coming to big city, major corrections facility, and then trying to learn about racism and everything that went into it. So it was certainly a learning curve experience for me as I started, and then moving up through my career. But man, I definitely was born for this profession.
Yeah.
And it's treated me well, and I've been blessed in every aspect that I've done.
Were you ever assigned to work narcotics?
I did. That was my favorite assignment.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, I did. And it was amazing. When I met my wife that I moved to California with is an ex-wife. And my current wife, I met her while I was undercover. And so I had long hair, I had a big, long goatee, just thick, black, big goatee. While I was dating her, I don't even think we were really serious and married yet, but at one point I shaved my head. So, I mean, how she stayed with me, I have no idea. But I was into that, and we were a combination. I was narcotics part of our enforcement team, mm-hmm. but it was a combination with gangs. So I concentrated on the drug part, but we had to do everything for Force Multiplier with our gang guys. So right. They helped us on our warrants. We helped them with them and their investigations and things like that. So I was predominantly into narcs, into drugs, and I absolutely loved it. I thought I was going to do that for the rest of my career. And it was a good thing.
All right. So did you ever watch Miami Vice?
I did.
And?
I think that was not my version of undercover narcotics. It was fun to watch. It was a good TV show, but it's TV.
Yeah, exactly.
In law enforcement, you realize it's like, hey, it's not really how it is on TV.
Yeah, that's, you know, I always wanted to be Sonny Crockett, you know, have the long flowing hair and the silk shirts and the bling.
Oh, yeah. Some gold chains and all that stuff. Yeah, it wasn't the same. I mean, just that. And because we talked about it then, of course, if you wore the wrong thing, then you would be called Sonny and Miami Vice or whatever it is, because it's just a different environment, that Florida beach environment to the Inland Empire Desert area that was when I was doing it. It was predominantly we were really the Inland Empire was the meth lab capital of the world, and so it was all that environment. It wasn't the beach with the wind blowing in your hair, and all that good stuff.
I was fortunate. My first assignment coming out of the DEA Academy was Miami in 1987. It was still the Wild West, but you know, wanting to get on that go fast boat, go out in the ocean, and come back and have all those bikini clad girls waiting on you. Yeah. I'm still waiting on that to happen.
Yeah, that's the version that it's TV.
That's exactly right. When did you ever envision when you became a police officer that you would move up in the ranks and become a leader?
No. I do have a funny story about that, though, because my first eval, your six-month evaluation, and my supervisor pulled me in and was asking me questions about me and my life and doing the stuff for my eval for work. And one of the last things she asked me was, what are my goals? And I didn't have any goals. And I'm like, oh, I don't know. I don't know if I have any goals. And she's like, well, everybody has goals. So I said, well, I want to get off probation. And she's like, that's not a goal. That's going to happen. And I'm like, well, I want to go out to patrol. And she's like, everybody goes out to patrol. That's not a goal. That's just the progression of what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And she's like, you've got to have a goal. How do you want to end your career? And I felt embarrassed that I didn't have a goal. And it's like, I don't know. I don't even know what I should be saying here. And I don't know why it popped into my head, but I said, well, I guess I want to be the sheriff. And she wrote that in my eval.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And so bad for me, when I went to patrol, now I transferred out of the jail. That's your old baby assignment. You go to the jail way back then. Now I'm going to a patrol assignment that now I'm on training. And my first day of training, I wanted to sit in the back, and the sergeant called me up front. He said, your seat's up here. And I walk up front, and there's a little paper placard where I'm sitting, and it says Sheriff Bianco.
Do you still have that?
No. That would have been nice to keep, but I was so embarrassed. So then that was a joke all along, that because they all knew what it was and why he was saying that. That sergeant was friends with my jail sergeant, and so she had told him what I had said and what she did. So I did not live that down. And so that, you know, that's always stayed with me. And especially as I started running for sheriff, people are like, hey, remember that first day of patrol? You were going to do this from the very beginning. But the reality is I never thought of that.
Right.
It was, I couldn't think of anything else. And so that's what popped into my head.
But it's a great example, because our regular listeners hear me say this all the time, is this is not an occupation you go into if you got thin skin. Because your first day in the academy or in your training session there, they're busting your chops.
Oh, yeah. That's one thing about me, is I've got a very good sense of humor. I certainly don't have thin skin. You can't say anything that's going to hurt my feelings or anything like that. And that works well here in our profession.
It does.
That works very well.
So what is, all these years later, what is the most dangerous situation that you remember being in, whether it was undercover, in a shootout, in a car chase, dealing with the public, whatever it might be?
Yeah, I've had several car chases that I look back and it's like, man, I mean, that was a tough one. And one in particular, I was going to help one of my partners. She had put out shots fired. And so I was going to help her, and someone pulled out in front of me, and there was no chance of stopping. And I tried to go around, and when I did, I missed her. But when I went around, I hit the dirt shoulder, and I was going fast. And coming back on, as soon as I hit pavement, I just immediately started rolling.
Oh.
And there were CHP following me because they saw how fast I was going, and they figured something was happening. It was in my community. They were my backup, especially at graveyard once the switch shift went home. And so they saw me and they followed me in case we needed something, and they saw the headlights. And I rolled, I flipped end over end. I completely wiped out a tree, took out a fire hydrant. I mean, the car was completely trashed. I had no injuries. I had nothing. It took a lot to get out of the car. CHP pulled me out of the window, but it was hard. It was so smashed, there was no room for me to get out. So it was hard wiggling my way out. But looking back, it's like, man, that was a close one. Looking at the car after, that was bad. And then probably the worst was a call for service of a person shooting in the neighborhood. And we got there and we tried to find it, me and my partner. And I don't know if we'd been given bad information or if he had moved or whatever it was. But as we're walking through this neighborhood, it's dark. I don't even know what time, probably 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night. And all of a sudden he started shooting at us, and we dropped down in this yard, and there was a little tiny retaining wall, a block retaining wall that was only two blocks high. And we're laying behind it, and he's shooting at us. I mean, the bullet, he's got a rifle, high power rifle, and it's destroying the blocks. And you can hear the bullets going over your head and everything else. And we really didn't know where he was coming from. And so that was a little terrifying, not at the time, because it's like, oh crap, how am I going to get out of here? And how am I going to shoot back? And all of those things. But later it was like, man, we're lucky we didn't get killed on that first volley of shots, because I had other friends in my career, two of them, that they rolled up on a domestic violence call. And as they were walking up to the house, two shots and both of them dead. And they were ambushed by a man with a high-powered rifle, and they were immediately killed with no chance of, they didn't even know what hit them.
Mm-hmm.
And so then this is a couple of years later, and now I go through this. It's like, holy crap, that could have been me.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things afterwards you think of it, but I wasn't thinking at the time. At the time it was, how am I going to get rid of him, and how am I going to get out of here? And so there's that adrenaline kicks in and takes over. Thankful for that, but...
You know what? Our regular listeners hear me say this all the time. It's simply by the grace of God. I'm not a believer in luck. I'm not a believer in coincidence. I believe everything happens for a reason. People always ask me, how did I survive this, that, and the other? And the same with you. It's not that we're supermen. It just wasn't our time to die.
Yeah. One of the things that I've really realized, I came from a religious family, but not a forced church going family. We just always believed in God and all those things. But especially in this career, as I progress through my career, and now all the younger deputies, as they're coming in, when I talk to all of them, when they come out of the academy, if you don't have faith in God, you have to get it.
Yeah.
Because it's going to help you cope with the bad parts of this job and the things that happen that you can't explain or that you can't understand. And so throughout my adulthood, whether it's things that happen to me or things that happen to my kids, I'm way past the part about coincidence and accidents and all those things. It's either your time or it's not, because there's so many things that influence. I mean, you forgetting your keys and taking 15 seconds to go back in and get your keys and then go out could have meant the difference between a life and death encounter. Yep. Somewhere down the road, somebody running a stoplight in front of you. And if you hadn't have forgot your keys, you would have got hit. Mm-hmm. I mean, truly do believe. And, you know, we've unfortunately had a couple of years ago, we had two deputies murdered 3 weeks apart. And if I didn't have a faith in God then and be able to help my department get through it with that faith, I don't know how I would have done it, because as the leader and as the person that I truly did feel responsible for them, they're like my kids.
Yeah.
And the second one, having to hold his pregnant wife, I tell her that he died.
Oh.
I couldn't have got through that either at that time or immediately after if I questioned things, if I questioned God or if I questioned life's mm-hmm. existence or anything else. It has to be my faith, knowing that there's something far better than what we have here, and the faith that we're here in a world of sin, waiting to go somewhere else. And I wouldn't consider myself a Bible thumper or anything like that, but I truly am a believer. And I know that that's what's gotten me through a lot of the hard times in life in general, not just work. But in this line of work,
mm-hmm.
you have to have that belief, because there are some things that are far beyond our ability to understand, control, or explain. And if you try and do it yourself, you just mess yourself up.
Right. When I was doing research on you before our interview, our discussion here, I saw where you listed your priorities as God, family, and service, which I agree with you 100%. That's the way it should be. The reality is it's usually police, 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 and then everything else.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I get a lot of messages from people that, hey, I read your book, I saw a TV series about you, I saw this, or I heard you speak, and I want to join law enforcement. What are your words of advice? My advice, and the reason I'm saying this is I'm curious to see if you agree with it. Be prepared to take a job that is not a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday, that will become your lifestyle, and that will not only affect you, but the people that are in your immediate circle that are most important to you, they're affected as well. I call them the unsung heroes, because we go out and we get to play and do what we love to do, which we think is exciting. And I think normal Americans are thinking, you guys are stupid for what you do. Why would you run towards the gunfire?
Especially now.
Yeah. But then we expect our wives or our husbands, our significant others, our children to just take care of business at home. I'm doing something that's important. And then we come home and they take care of us.
Yeah.
So
I'm the exact same way. And one of the things, when there's a lot of people that ask, like, hey, I'm thinking about getting into law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I ask is, are you married? And what does your spouse think? And then talk through that. Because if they don't want you to do it, I don't think your marriage is going to last.
Right.
Because
there's
they've got a lot of apprehensions for some reason, and you're doing it on your own. And this career was just as much my wife's as it was mine. She had to deal with every aspect that I had to deal with. And she had her own things.
Yep.
She had, you know, when I'm working graveyard, the kids wake up in the middle of the night, I can't help. And when they have to wake up early in the morning to go to school, I can't help. Mm-hmm. I'm working. And she took on a whole lot. So it's not just us that gets into this. This is a family event, and it's a family career. And with that, I say, it's going to be amazing for you as long as you keep your priorities straight and you don't become the job. You have to remain yourself. That can't be your identity. But I always had Sunday, Monday, Tuesday off. And Monday, Tuesday, my kids loved it, especially in the summertime, because we'd be on the lake and be the only persons on the lake because everybody else is working.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is awesome. And, you know, you work 4 days a week, 3 days, 4 days, 3 days, 4 days, 3 days, 4 day weekends every other week. That's a pretty good deal. That's a pretty good career.
Yeah.
And we'd work it out with my wife. And for Christmas, I'd work extra overtime. And this career took care of us. And there are certainly sacrifices, but there are rewards too. And looking back, I wouldn't do anything different.
I'm with you.
And I think that my love for this, for what I'm doing, shows through my daughter wanting to do this.
Oh, yeah.
it's just a great career.
It is. It is. And I got to throw out kudos to my wife because she was a registered nurse who I transferred, I think, 8 moves in my 26 years with DEA, continually had to give up her career for me. And even now in retirement, as I'm getting older, I'm getting a little bit slower and got a lot of irons in the fire. And she has taken over editing my episodes on this podcast.
Oh, nice.
So even we've been married 41 years now. I think it's going to last.
It sounds like you actually found your partner.
I did.
So that's awesome.
Couldn't do this without her. Hey, gang, this is the end of part one. Part two comes out tomorrow, and you certainly don't want to miss that. In the meantime, just a reminder that Game of Crimes is now posting interview videos on YouTube. You can find those and you can subscribe at Game of Crimes Podcast. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com, where you'll find all our episodes, our guest book list, and more. And for more content, join us on patreon.com/gameofcrimes. I have several monthly episodes that range from silly to serious, so come on over and join the fun. In the meantime, everyone stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.